Out front next, breaking news, Trump hunting for one holdout as more than half of the potential jurors today are out, saying they cannot be fair and impartial. So who's left? We're going to break this down for you. And it's not if, but when Israel will retaliate against Iran. The region on edge tonight as Iran warns don't cross any red lines. A special report on what's happening inside Iran tonight coming up. Plus, Truth Social shares plunging today, hundreds of millions of dollars erased from the company's market value as Trump followers keep buying up shares. Let's go out front. And good evening, I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, the hunt for Trump's jury, his criminal jury, and we are down to 32 potential jurors from this morning's 96. And tonight, the first ever criminal trial of a former president is officially underway. Now, Trump is required to be there every single day. In fact, he can actually be jailed for contempt if he doesn't show up. And today, when the judge read him those rules, he was emotionless as he agreed. According to the New York Times, he actually chuckled when the judge told jurors that he will ensure a fair trial. Then, when he left the courtroom, he went to the cameras to speak out about it.
It's a scam. It's a political witch hunt. It continues, and it continues forever. And we're not going to be given a fair trial.
Well, as to a fair trial, the jurors in that room seem to take their duty as citizens deeply seriously. Well, Trump, according to the Times, appeared irritated throughout the day, paying a lot of attention during juror selection, but did appear to doze off a few times this morning before jury selection began. But then we know Trump turned to watch as that first group entered the courtroom, and that was around 2:30 Eastern time today. Many prospective jurors in the back rows stretched their necks, lifted their heads. They were trying to get a look at the former president. One woman giggled, as our pool reporter was saying, putting her hand over her mouth, looking at the person next to her with raised eyebrows. And the reality of it is this. There were 96 possible jurors initially brought into that room, and at least 50 raised their hands when asked specifically about whether they would be biased or not able to be impartial. They said that they couldn't be, and that's honesty. And of course, Trump only needs one juror to vote against conviction to win. And even based on how Manhattan voted in the last election, as our Harry Antonis pointed out, a random group of 12 Manhattanites would include a Trump supporter. You'd like to think this is not what a jury is going to come down to, but it's still important to point out in the context of the words from the former president. And here is some of what we do know about the jurors who were excused today. One potential juror was heard in the hallway saying, "I just couldn't do it," while leaving the courtroom. A few others were excused due to personal conflicts. So now you say, what do we know about the 32 remaining, some of whom might actually be on the final jury? Well, here's a little bit of what we know. We know there's a woman among them who told the court she lives in Midtown Manhattan, married without children, works in business development for a venture capital firm. Says she likes going to restaurants in the city. Another woman living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, married without children. She works in city government. Says she likes cooking artwork and going to shows. And then there was a man in Midtown Manhattan. He says he's married with a child and works as a creative director, telling the court he enjoys hiking and cooking. All three get their news, they say, from the New York Times and CNN, and two also listed the Wall Street Journal and Google. Now, that is a Manhattan standard operating procedure group of people. But that's what we know so far. Paula Reed is out front outside the courthouse. And Paula, I know I was there with you today, and now you've gotten even more information here as those jurors left the room. Trump making some false statements outside of court where you are about what the judge will and won't allow him to do. So what's the reality of the situation?
Erin, it was kind of surprising after everything that had happened today. What Trump was focused on when he walked out of the court was the fact that he is required as a criminal defendant to attend every day of these proceedings unless he is granted a waiver. And once he walked out of the courtroom, he repeatedly claimed that the judge is preventing him from attending his son Barron's high school graduation. The problem, Erin, is that the judge hasn't ruled on that issue. The judge said he can't rule on that at this time. But that didn't stop one of Trump's adult sons from amplifying that falsehood on social media. Now, Trump's lawyers also asked if their client could get a waiver for next Thursday. The Supreme Court arguments on whether Trump has presidential immunity to shield him in one of his three other criminal cases, the federal election subversion case. But there, the judge did rule, and he said that he will see Trump back here in New York next Thursday. He said, look, there's no requirement for you to be at the Supreme Court argument, but you are required to be here as a criminal defendant. So I think this is going to be a pet issue for the former president, something we're going to hear a lot about as he tries to continue to frame himself as the victim of an unfair system.
Yeah, absolutely. And fascinating, Paul. Of course, part of the reason maybe no ruling yet on his son's graduation is they don't know whether the trial will still be going on when his son, Barron, graduates from high school. All right. Thank you very much, Paula. And I've got our Outfront experts here who are going to be covering this trial with us. I want to begin with Robert Hirschhorn, though, a jury consultant. And Robert, I know you've got four decades of experience, the William Kennedy Smith rape trial, the George Zimmerman trial. So you've been doing this a long time. You get 96. This is the first group, right? They're going to keep going by groups of about 100 until they're able to seat the full jury of 12 and then alternates. You were actually surprised that only 50% of the potential jurors, or a little bit over, were let go because they couldn't be fair?
I was, Aaron. Thanks for having me back on the show. You did a great job today reporting from outside the courthouse. Yeah, because look, Trump keeps talking about how we can't get a fair trial, and out of the first 96, there were only 50 that was excused. I would have expected more like 75 or 80 that would have said they'd formed an opinion. So he may be saying for the camera he can't get a fair trial, but Aaron, I think the man can.
You think he can? And
yes,
Mimi, obviously Westchester DA, do you agree with that too from what we saw today? And more than half of them immediately raised their hands.
Yeah, I do agree with that. It's a little bit of a, you know, do you look at this glass half empty or half full?
Right.
And I was, I'm looking at this as half full, that there are, first of all, that so many people were presumably honest. I'm sure there's some people that just wanted to get off because serving on any jury is burdensome for people.
Right.
But presumably a lot of them are honest, and that's how we're going to get to a fair and impartial jury. And I say that not just based on this case or what happened today, but really based on, 20 years of watching juries. Joey Jackson may have a different view, but I think that when the judge instructs people that whatever your personal beliefs, you have to put that aside and decide this case based on the evidence in the courtroom and that only, I mean, call me sentimental, but I believe that that has quite an impact on jurors.
People get sworn in as they were today for that. So, Joey, what do you think? Obviously, you've done this for a long time as well with jury selection. You also know Judge Mershon, who is obviously the judge in the case.
Yeah, I think he's a person of great competence and of great faith. I think that'll be important as we move forward. But look, here's what I view. I think today the system worked. And why do I say that? You know, yes, I'm a defense attorney. Everyone's presumed innocent until proven guilty. We can agree to that. But the reality is that this judge has been really gone out of his way to be fair. Why? Generally speaking, when you have prosecutors and defense attorneys in a courtroom and people say, I can't be fair, the judge says, come here, let me talk to you. And then in speaking with that person, in essence, rehabilitates them to get them on the jury. This judge said, look, to any person who does that, because I want to have abundant caution for the fairness of this trial, what I'm going to do is to just excuse them. And so I think that's a system that works. And how else does it work, Aaron? It works because in addition to those that are excused because they noted they can't be fair and have bias, you have these challenges for cause. What does that mean in English? It means that if jurors can't be fair in an unlimited fashion, if you could demonstrate that they have some kind of bias based on further questioning, they will be excused as well. And so I do believe, right, that in essence, you're going to have a fair jury, an impartial jury, who will be able to adjudicate this case on the merits in the courtroom as they see.
And what did you notice from the former president today as he watched? We know, we understood maybe in the preamble to the jury selection, he may have dozed off a couple times. But when the jury walked in, it appears he was very, very focused.
He was focused at the very start when he and his lawyers stood up and were introduced to the group of 96 people. But I do have to say that as that process itself dragged on, Trump did continue to look a little bit perhaps bored. He closed his eyes again. I wouldn't say he was necessarily asleep. But it's a long process. It's a long day for everyone involved. But tomorrow is going to be a full day of jury selection with each of these potential jurors being questioned probably throughout the entire day. And that might keep his interest up a little bit more, especially if someone one of these jurors comes out as, being pro-Trump. He's gotten excited about that in past trials, the E. Jean Carroll trial. When they were identified.
And of course, all he needs is one in this case, because it's criminal, one juror to vote on his behalf.
It could be an anti-Trump juror, too, who votes
right.
against conviction.
Right. I mean, that's right to your point about how seriously people take it. Ryan, what about the timing here? I mean, now we're one day in. We went through 96 people. 32 of them are going to come back tomorrow, still have to be questioned. And then there's another group of 100 that can keep feeding in until you finish the selection. And that's just the selection. Originally, everyone had thought this was done by Memorial Day. Is it?
It's hard to know. I mean, the judge did say that he expects the trial itself to take 6 weeks after the jury is seated. And now the big question is how long it'll take to seat the jury. Mm-hmm. There was some speculation, myself included, that there might be people who really want to be on the jury. And that it would go faster, didn't seem to play out today. It didn't seem as though these individuals...
Yeah, I would have thought there would be some people who would think there was a moment, you know, to be part of history. And maybe there will be, but it wasn't the initial impact that you got from that. And Robert, what did you make of what one thing that you saw in this courtroom? And I'm going to ask about the few jurors that we know of specifically who may still be on the case. But overall, this was a very diverse room, just like any group of 96 people in Manhattan is going to be. And you think that's good for the defense?
I think it's good for both. Look, you're not guaranteed a jury of the people you want on it. What you're guaranteed is a cross-section of the community. That's who showed up. The people that expressed an initial opinion, like Joey was saying, that they can't be fair, they got excused. There's still a couple more opportunities for more jurors to be excused for challenges for cause, which, by the way, are unlimited. There's no number. The peremptory strikes, those are the ones that are 10. But if a juror has a bias, expresses any type of bias, that's called a challenge for cause. It's unlimited. So you've got the questioning that's going to go through each of the jurors. Then, as I understand it, the lawyers be allowed to follow up with some of the jurors outside the presence and hearing of the other jurors. There's another opportunity to get a juror off for a cause. I'm telling you, Aaron, it's going to take a while to pick this jury. I wouldn't be surprised if it's 3 or 4 weeks because, there's a lot of work that has to be done, and they need a bunch of jurors.
Yeah, and they're not going to go on Wednesdays, and I don't know exactly what's going to end up happening with Passover, but all of a sudden, when you talk about 3 to 4 weeks, you're not talking about 20 days. You're talking about a lot less than that. So, Mimi, let me ask you about the people we do know. And again, there's 32 that may be on this jury. They're not all going to be, but somebody might be. But the ones that I gave the description of, a woman, these are Manhattanites, okay? A creative director married with a kid, an unmarried woman in city government, loves going to shows, loves cooking, a woman in business development for a VC firm, venture capital firm, married with no children, likes going to restaurants. All of them list New York Times and CNN as news sources. Yet none of them were struck just for that, right? I mean, so that gets into, I guess, the depth of the juror questionnaire.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there are many more questions on that questionnaire that will get to this bias that everybody's talking about that would disqualify someone. And again, it's not just any bias. It's a bias that renders you incapable of being fair and impartial.
Right, which is different than coming in with an opinion, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it's whether you can set that opinion aside.
Yes. I mean, I've said this before, but, I had an investigation of the Trump Organization in my office. We did not bring charges. I've said this publicly before.
Yeah.
I have spoken very critically of former President Trump on a personal level about him as a president and as a candidate. I was able to put that aside when looking at evidence, right? And that's what we ask jurors to do. And again, there's something about, I think you used a phrase in your opening about sort of how seriously this jury, potential jury, it's a big deal. And when you take that oath and you're in that setting, even in a state court, which isn't as regal as, maybe federal court, I think people, that doesn't mean, I mean, we have hung juries and they happen a lot because people aren't completely honest or don't put it aside. But I do have faith in the system.
And could you read from anything about what the jury, how they were reacting?
No, it's really just impossible to tell at this point. It's a little too early. I think we got to get a little
further along. Too many of them in the room to get a feel. Yeah.
Right. But I think that they'll definitely be able to find plenty who will be able to be non-biased, as you point out, they usually do.
And in the room, when they asked a question about bias and impartiality, did the hands shoot up? Did they kind of look around to see who else's hand was up? I'm curious about this moment.
They all went up at once. I think everyone already knew that the answer to that question, that it was coming. There were a lot of, the questionnaire included a lot of questions about bias and whether or not you could be fair. So I think they saw it coming. And I think that probably a lot of them know from TV or whatever that that's a way that you're immediately going to be let off of the jury. And I think that we'll probably see something similar tomorrow.
Right, as you get another 100 people.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll see, based upon the new pool, what they have to say. They'll be given the same opportunity to self-identify and say, hey, I can't be fair, I'm going to go. And some will give the indication they can be. They'll be questioned. And just a really, really quick point. Yes, we can talk about the individual jurors, et cetera. I'm very against stereotypes. I'm against any biases as it relates to us. You know, I like restaurants, I like movies. You have to probe, you have to ask questions. Although you probably could discern based upon New York Times, CNN, you know, you can discern the leanings of someone,
right.
But it needs further
and that's,
probing.
And as Amy's saying, that's separate from how they may look at the case.
Without
just
question.
Because they may come in, they may not be a Trump voter. Who knows? I'm not saying, but you know, okay. Doesn't mean you can't be fair and unbiased.
1,000%. And the judge will say repeatedly in the instructions, it's not who you like, it's not who you dislike. Can you base it on the evidence in the court?
All right. Thanks very much to all as we continue to cover this. And as we said, there's going to be a whole other group coming in tomorrow, in addition to the 32 that they still need to go through left over from today. Well, next is District Attorney Alvin Bragg ready. This is the biggest test of his career. A longtime friend and colleague of Bragg joins me next. Plus, breaking news in the Middle East, Israel preparing to strike back against Iran's attack. Iran warning tonight of red lines. And secrecy at the Supreme Court. Justice Clarence Thomas mysteriously missing from the bench. The court refusing tonight to say why.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life... Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to 1.5 eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tonight, the face-off, former President Donald Trump and Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg were together in the same room today, the courtroom. Trump's disdain for the district attorney made clear as he left court tonight.
He's sitting here all day with about 10 or 12 prosecutors over what people say shouldn't be a trial.
Bragg says it is not about politics, that he's doing his job. So what is the truth about the man at the center of this who is not named Donald Trump, Alvin Bragg? Jason Carroll is out front.
Alvin Bragg could be described as a man with a few notable firsts behind his name.
Good afternoon.
He's 50 years old, and in 2022, he became the first black Manhattan district attorney, and now he's the first to prosecute a criminal case involving a former U.S. president, Donald Trump. Bragg had a prestigious early start. He attended Trinity School, an elite private school on Manhattan's Upper West Side. But back in his neighborhood, he says he was often wrongly stopped by police as a teenager. He gave insight into his experiences during his campaign for office.
When I think about police accountability, I think about the NYPD stopping me 3 times at gunpoint as a kid. When I think about violent crime, I think about having a knife to my neck, a semi-automatic weapon to my head, and a homicide victim on my doorstep.
Bragg's interest in law started early. He graduated from Harvard Law. A 1995 article in the Harvard Crimson credited him for moderating a discussion between black and Jewish students, calling him the anointed one for his ability to reconcile diverse people and clashing views. Bragg's resume lists a series of prestigious offices. He served as assistant attorney in the Southern District of New York, a top lawyer in the New York Attorney General's office, a professor of the New York Law School Racial Justice Project. That's where he represented the family of Eric Garner. The family sued the city after a plainclothed officer put him in an unauthorized chokehold after he was caught selling loose cigarettes. Garner's death in 2014 sparked outrage and protests nationwide. Bragg credits his interest in police reform to his years growing up here in Harlem, where he says once again he was unfairly stopped by police as a child. His mother was a teacher, his father a social worker, according to the New York Times. And Bragg now taking on his highest profile case to date, his case against the former president, underway.
These are felony crimes in New York State. No matter who you are, we cannot and will not normalize serious criminal conduct.
Bragg, who is a Democrat, making good on a campaign promise to make Trump a priority.
I'm ready to go wherever the facts take me. I believe we have to hold them accountable.
Trump has called his trial political persecution and has repeatedly directed his anger at Bragg, someone he's called an animal and a degenerate.
The racist Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, who is presiding over one of the most dangerous and violent cities in the United States.
It should be noted that Bragg's office has received racist threats. They've received threats of violence since taking on the case, but Bragg has remained committed to the case. Aaron saying the following: someone lied again and again to protect their interests and evade the laws to which we are all held accountable. Aaron.
All right, Jason, thank you very much. And Terry Gerstein's out front now. She worked with Alvin Bragg as a prosecutor in the New York Attorney General's office. And Terry, you worked with him. He was your direct supervisor for several years. I know you're also friends with him. You know him well. So what kind of a prosecutor is he?
So Alvin, or DA Bragg, he's very cautious. He's careful. He's really, really a very smart lawyer, smart in a strategic, lawyerly way, smart about people. But he's also just very, very committed to justice. I think one thing people don't know about him is the extent to which this trial in this case is just a small sliver of what his office is focusing on and what he's doing. He really is focused. During the campaign, he talked about ending two systems of justice, where there were, you know, one system for people who were wealthy and connected and another for everyone else, and really trying to bring about a different way of approaching the office.
So in this particular case, he is obviously, he's making history, right? He's the first prosecutor to put a former, an American president on trial. And yet, you know, we've all heard from the very beginning, this is the least consequential, the least strong, the most political case. I mean, this has been a talking point from the beginning. It's not going to be the only case we're probably going to get a verdict in of all of them, though. But one of the complaints specifically has been that these are misdemeanor charges, and he elevated these charges to felonies. And that is where this is going to fall apart with the jury. Not whether he made a payment, not whether it's the felony aspect of it. I know that you supervise cases like this, criminal cases like this, for 6 years, right? So this is your bread and butter. You know it. What do you think?
So we routinely, I was the labor bureau chief, and so we brought wage theft cases, cases involving employers who were cheating on their unemployment taxes and other kinds of workplace laws. And we routinely brought cases where there were charges of false business records as felonies. This is a very common charge, not just in the workers' rights space, but throughout New York state criminal practice. And so that aspect of it, saying that these are, you know, that this is something that's never prosecuted, that's just simply not true.
That's untrue. All right.
Yeah.
So now the other criticism, and Jason just referenced this in his piece, but Bragg's, some of the criticism has been, well, how he got elected to begin with, right? He's a Democrat, and this is the way we do it in this, you know, you run for DA. So people are parties, and what you get out of that is someone who has a political party. And in his case, he had talked specifically about how he was going to hold Trump to account if he won. It was part of his platform. And the most infamous soundbite is this one.
I'm the candidate in the race who has the experience with Donald Trump. I was the chief deputy in the Attorney General's office. We sued the Trump administration over 100 times.
So, you know, you worked on his campaign. I mean, I understand, you know, you support him, but What do you say to people who say this is politics? He ran on saying, I'm going to go get Donald Trump, and then he went and did that.
Well, so I did volunteer on his campaign, as did many dozens and dozens of us who worked in the office, even though he was no longer there, because we all really believed in him, having worked with him for years. And the truth is that on his campaign, looking at his campaign literature, going to the events, he talked about so many different things. He talked about, as I said, ending two systems of justice. He talked about public service. He talked about bringing workers' rights cases and protecting tenants and taking a different approach that would be more strategic and preventive of crime. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, yes, the issue of Donald Trump came up when he was questioned, and he answered honestly that the attorney general's office in New York, where he was the number two, the first deputy,
right,
had brought cases, as had many other AG offices in California and Massachusetts and many other states. And so it certainly was something that came up, but it was by no means the highlight of his campaign.
So you don't think of the focus?
No, not at all.
All right. Well, Terry, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And it's important for everyone to get a better sense of both people. And of course, there'll be all the jurors, but both people at the center of this right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
And out front next, we do have breaking news. Israel now vowing to respond and soon to Iran's massive missile and drone attack. And tonight we're hearing from people inside Iran calling for the complete destruction of Israel. Plus, Truth Social's shares tanking almost 20% just today, as some Trump supporters are actually now dumping their life savings into the company. We'll tell you more.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish. So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protests that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Breaking news. On the brink of all-out war, the head of the IDF telling troops Iran's attack will be, quote, met with response, meaning it's not a question of if Israel retaliates, but when. Iran saying just moments ago it will respond in, quote, seconds if Israel makes another mistake. Those are their words. Jeremy Diamond is out front in Tel Aviv tonight. Jeremy, what more are you learning about how Israel plans to retaliate against Iran, since it now seems to be a matter of a matter of when and not if?
Well, Aaron, over the course of the last 48 hours, there have been heated debates within the Israeli war cabinet about the scope and timing of an Israeli response to those Iranian attacks over the course of the weekend, the first Iranian attacks on Israeli soil. But there's no question that the Israeli war cabinet is united in its determination to carry out some kind of response to Iran's attack over the weekend. Today, the Israeli military's chief of staff saying that Iran will face consequences for its actions.
Iran will face the consequences for its actions. We will choose our response accordingly. The IDF remains ready to counter any threat from Iran and its terror proxies as we continue our mission to defend the State of Israel.
And interestingly, Aaron, while yesterday, after hours of deliberations, Israeli officials came out afterwards and told us that no decision had been made, after nearly 3 hours of deliberations today in the war cabinet, Israeli officials would not say whether or not a decision has been made. Instead, one Israeli official telling me that there was a sense after this meeting that an action would be taken sooner rather than later. So while we don't know the exact timing of a potential Israeli response, the sense is that this will happen sooner rather than later. Now, the question is exactly what type of response is Israel going to go for? They reviewed multiple military options today. I'm told that one of those options was potentially hitting an Iranian facility inside of Iran that would not cause, civilian casualties. But of course, that is just one of several options. And of course, what Israel chooses to do here will certainly have massive ramifications that will ripple throughout the region. Aaron?
Well, it certainly will. Thank you very much, Jeremy. And Iran, of course, threatening, as I said, that if Israel does something, they'll respond in, quote unquote, seconds. Meanwhile, in Iran, Citizens are speaking out, calling for the destruction of Israel and its chief ally, the United States. Our Fred Pleichen covers Iran extensively. In fact, was just in Tehran and is out front now with the Iranian reaction.
Iranian combat drones fired into the night sky. This new video shown on Iran's state media. Part of the country's massive aerial attack for the first time targeting Israeli territory. Hundreds of drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles. And yet, Iran calls this measured action and vows things could get much worse for the Israelis.
We have carried out this action in the framework of deterrence. If another action is taken by Israel, our actions will be more serious.
On the streets of Tehran, some hardliners celebrated with fireworks, calling for even harsher action and even the destruction of Israel.
We hope this attack continues to the point that Israel is destroyed. With this attack, we can have some of that strong revenge.
The punishment is for the bombing of a building in their embassy compound in Damascus, killing several top Revolutionary Guard commanders. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, a rifle by his side, calling for retribution during a speech one day before the strikes. And the commander of the Revolutionary Guard saying, from now on, they will hit Israel every time it strikes their forces, a strategic shift.
From now on, if the Zionist regime attacks our interests, our properties, our personalities, and our citizens, we will retaliate against them from the territory of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
With the help of the U.S. and its allies, the Israelis were able to take out nearly all of the drones and missiles the Iranians fired at them. But Israeli strikes on targets inside Iran, like the country's nuclear facilities, as some U.S. hardliners have called for, would be a major challenge. And Iran already warning the U.S.'s assets in the Middle East would also become a target if America helps Israel attack Iran.
The American bases, personnel, and facilities will not have security in the region, and we see America as an aggressor and will deal with them as well.
And Aaron, tonight, more tough talk coming from the Iranians. A senior advisor to the commander of the Revolutionary Guard Quds Force, that is, of course, the foreign operations wing of the Revolutionary Guard, saying that while Iran does not seek war, they also say they will show no restraint if Iran's red lines are attacked. Aaron?
Fred, thank you very much. And I want to go straight now to the retired Army Lieutenant General Mark Hertling and Karim Sajapour, Iran policy expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks to both. General Hertling, Israel's war cabinet meeting, the Israeli officials, the reporting from Jeremy Diamond that they are going to respond sooner rather than later. Iran, in response, has said they'll respond within seconds. What does this look like right now, General?
It looks like a mess, Aaron, is what it looks like. But what we have to consider is the culture of both of these nations. Israel has been attacked multiple times, not just by Iran, but by their proxies, by terrorist groups. So the culture inside that war cabinet is looking for revenge. Many offers were probably made by different members of that cabinet about what should happen next. But the hardliners in the streets of Israel want something to happen. And as Fred's report showed, the same thing has happened in Iran. So you not only have the strategic pressure of Israel fighting multiple fronts in different kinds of wars, but you also have the potential for Iran being pushed by the hardliners, certainly not representative of all of their people, but being pushed that way. So you're going to see some actions. In the war cabinet today, I'm sure they discussed what was the spectrum of operations. Could it be kinetic strikes by themselves, kinetic strikes mixed with cyber attacks and special operations forces? And I'm sure even in some cases they said, let's not do nothing. We had a good night the other night. Let's continue with the peace and focused on Gaza. So all those things are playing a part, and it is just a mess.
I mean, Karim, when you talk about Israel responding sooner rather than later, and Iran had said, look, this was their response to the the attack on their general and team at the embassy annex in Damascus, and that they would call it a day. It's over. But then they say they'll respond within seconds if Israel responds now. Is that serious?
I'm reminded of Gandhi's quote that an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. I think that the challenge Iran has is like any dictatorship. It wants to be feared by its population. And so I think among the reasons that they felt the need to retaliate against Israel, obviously they want to send the signal that their generals can't be assassinated cost-free. They wanted to win plaudits and admiration from the Arab and Muslim street. But this is a country, Iran, in which last year, if you remember, Aaron, there were mass protests against the government. And the government doesn't want to look weak in the eyes of its people. So I actually, despite what we saw earlier, people taking to the streets and calling for vengeance against Israel, I suspect that most Iranians are really praying that they can avoid conflict.
General Hertling, to that effect, some who are advocating for Israel to strike directly back on Iranian soil, which Jeremy said is one of the options being considered, clearly, are calling for this to be an incredibly aggressive. John Bolton, Iran hawk, he's calling specifically for Israel to respond by hitting some of the Iranian nuclear facilities, targeting the nuclear weapons program. Obviously, a targeting of a nuclear weapons facility, whether it be power-driven, like Bushehr, or some of those other locations on the map that are clearly part of the nuclear weapons program as well, truly could escalate this situation to, some sort of a horrific world war. What do you think?
I agree with you completely. And I'm thanking the good Lord every night that John Bolton is in no way influencing any of the decision makers right now. Because if Israel were to strike any nuclear facilities inside of Iran, that would light the fuse. And it doesn't matter which side would win or which side would be on top. It would be a horrific war situation. And by the way, Israel has other methods of affecting Iran's nuclear facilities. They've shown that in the past. So it doesn't take a kinetic strike. It takes the kinds of strikes where you can be covert and claim plausible deniability on what exactly happened, although most people will understand what happens. Yeah, I agree that this is not something that both nations should go to war about, because if that happens, the entire Middle East will go up in flames. Iran is not looking good right now based on the attack the other night, both from their capability, but also the very fact that they did it. And most of the region is running contrary to Iran right now. And it's changed from most of the region being against Israel just a week ago. So we're seeing some dynamics play out that will certainly affect the context and certainly affect future actions. I just hope both sides are careful about what their next actions are.
Kareem, can I just ask you, today John Kirby said something at the White House, it was basically, the sort of narrative that's taken control seems to be along the lines of, look, Iran knew what they were going to do. They telegraphed it. They told everybody, basically, all short of putting marks of tape on the ground of where they were going to aim, of what they were going to do. And the whole point was show of force. And they knew Israel and the U.S. and Jordan would take it out of the sky and then they could move on. And that's the whole point of it. And John Kirby at the White House says that that's absolutely not true. Here's what he said.
I've seen reporting that the Iranians meant to fail. That this spectacular and embarrassing failure was all by design. I've also seen Iran say that they provided early warning to help Israel prepare its defenses and limit any potential damage. All of this is categorically false. To coin the phrase from the president, or steal a phrase from the president, it's malarkey.
Is it malarkey, Kareem? Did Iran actually think any of those things were going to go through with the way they telegraphed it or not?
Aaron, I spoke to a senior White House official yesterday who echoed Kirby's words. He said, listen, when you launch 100 ballistic missiles, that's serious. That was intended, in his words, to cause serious, serious destruction. And, in the past, Iran hasn't restrained itself against Israel. They praised the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel. What's different this time is that they haven't operated via proxy. And I think Iran's hope, frankly, it's an irony given that their ideology is premised on hostility towards the United States. But I think now Iran is hoping that the Biden administration will exercise restraint over Israel.
Well, we'll see if they'll succeed. Prime Minister Netanyahu has not listened much to the U.S. president in recent months. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it. And coming up out front this week, I will be speaking to the foreign minister of Iran. And you won't want to miss our face-to-face conversation Friday night. You will see it. We will air it here at 7. And meantime, next here tonight, Trump's Truth Social nosedive. The shares plunging nearly 20% just today. Hundreds of millions of dollars in value lost as Trump supporters still put money in. And Justice Clarence Thomas missing from the Supreme Court today, but no explanation was given. This is just ahead of Trump's immunity trial, days away. What's going on? Tonight, Truth Social tanking. Donald Trump's shares today plunging more than 18%. The latest plunge coming amid news that the social media company is putting another 21.5 million shares up for sale. The company's bleeding money, so they want to issue more shares to raise the money. But of course, when you issue new shares, that means the already existing shares get diluted. They lose value. And the share price has already fallen by half. Trump himself has actually lost almost $3 billion since Truth Social went public less than 3 weeks ago, all on paper. Out front now, Dan Alexander, the senior editor at Forbes. So, Dan, you know, flooding the market with new shares, what is the bottom line for small investors who bought into Trump's company because they believe in him?
Well, the bottom line is that they are going to get diluted. And this makes it more likely that they are going to lose money. The problem here is that this SPAC was set up and the deal was set up in a way that allowed a lot of Wall Street insiders and Trump and the other people involved with his company to get in at very, very discounted rates. Meanwhile, all the retail shareholders were putting up huge sums to buy in. And the ultimate effect is that they put in the cash and the other people walk away with the shares.
I mean, it was unbelievable, as you point out, right? Trump and every the insiders have got the shares for rock bottom, right? Then it goes public and the people who buy at those prices get hurt the most. I mean, anyone who bought Trump Media shares when it peaked, and I guess, Dan, that was, what, $66 per share. So they've now lost half their money. And just to be clear, people who got in and bought at that price were not inside, you know, sophisticated Wall Street insiders, right? These were small-time investors who support Donald Trump, wanted to support his company. There was a person who put a large chunk of his life savings in this company. He told the Washington Post, Dan, I know good and well it's in Trump's hands and he's got plans. I have no doubt it's going to explode sometime. I mean, that's actually makes me really sad. I mean, how do you even react to that?
Yeah. It is a sad story, you know, and the trouble here is that if you look at the fundamentals of the company, it's poised to go down a lot more. If you look at the number of users that this company has, the amount of revenue that it generates, you know, its valuation should be measured in the hundreds of millions of dollars at the most. Right now, the public markets are valuing it at $3.5 billion. So that means that this stock should fall by at least another 90% before the metrics start to make any amount of sense. And for people who are just blindly putting their faith in Trump and in the company, that means that they could stand to lose a lot of money. And if somebody's just throwing a couple of, you know, $1,000 that they have extra, okay, fine. You know, people donate to political campaigns too. But if somebody's putting a significant chunk of their life savings into it, they could really get wiped out by the very person who they're trusting their money to, saying this guy is going to make this company an amazing venture.
I mean, it's incredible what you're saying there. You're saying, so we'd already look at something that's lost half its value since March 26th, half its value. But you're saying it could go down another 90%?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, if you look at the company's own filings, you know, they're saying that its accountants had questions about whether it could continue as a going concern. They're saying that bankruptcy is not out of the question eventually. So this thing could go to zero eventually. But just if you look at the actual business fundamentals right now, and you stack that up against, for example, the valuation of Twitter or of Facebook, you know, some other social media companies, and you try to correlate those and make it make sense, we're so far away from that point right now that it looks like this stock should continue falling drastically.
All right. Thank you very much, Dan. Good to see you.
Yeah, likewise.
All right. The next mystery at the Supreme Court, Justice Clarence Thomas, not in court today, and no one is saying why. And finally, tonight, a Supreme Court mystery. Justice Clarence Thomas missing oral arguments today for two cases before the court. Chief Justice John Roberts making a quick announcement that Thomas would not be present, but no explanation was given for his absence. Now, the court does usually give an explanation for a justice's absence. And we've also seen justices take part in arguments remotely when they are sick. And the context here is not just the lack of transparency, but that it also comes just 1 week before the Supreme Court hears oral arguments on whether or not Donald Trump is protected from criminal prosecutions because of presidential immunity, because he was president when the acts were committed. A case critics of Thomas argue he should recuse himself from because of his wife's Ginny's efforts to help Trump's team overturn the 2020 election. Thomas is 75. He is the most senior associate justice on the Supreme Court. He missed several arguments in 2022 with an infection. And tonight, the Supreme Court is not responding to a request for additional information about Thomas's leave of absence today, leaving many important questions unanswered. Well, thank you so very much for joining us. We'll see you here tomorrow. AC 360 begins now.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.